You need to be curious, you need to know how to research, and you need to care. And if you have those three things and you're willing to spend a little bit of extra time on the weekends or in the evenings when non-billable to actually get the ropes, then you can do it even without the background. But what you can't do is come into it just thinking it's going to be the same as any other lawyer job, because it is very scientific. And so if you're not interested in the science, if you're not interested in understanding these cool new technologies and then going to the dentist and being like, hey, I actually worked on that product. If that doesn't make you feel like a cool nerd, then it's probably not the space for you.
Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. Now let's get started. Hello and welcome back. In today's episode, I speak with Suzanne Levy-Friedman, who's currently a senior associate in the Medical Devices and Technology Regulatory Group at the law firm of Hogan Lovells in Washington, D.C. In that role, Suzanne assists device companies in a wide range of activities across the lifecycle of products, including preparing regulatory submissions for clearance or approval, advising manufacturers on the lawful promotion and advertising of their devices, and dealing with post-market enforcement issues. She has a particular specialty and interest in dealing with the FDA's evolving paradigm for software and digital health products, and she's helped clients determine the appropriate regulatory pathways for products in that space. In law school, Suzanne interned at the FDA's Office of Chief Counsel, where she learned about the range of legal and regulatory issues addressed by the agency. And she spent 2 years before law school with a health policy consulting firm in D.C. Suzanne's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania School of Law and holds a master's in bioethics from Penn's Medical School. Go Quakers. She's also a graduate of Princeton, where she and I were classmates. Go Tigers. So grateful I could convince you to come on the podcast. Great to have you, Suzanne.
Yeah, thanks, Jonah, for having me.
I just gave the canned spiel of what you do, but what I really want to hear is how you describe your practice, both what kinds of cases you work on, but also what you do every day to someone who's less familiar with your area of law.
Yeah, of course. What I do is probably an area of law that a lot of people don't even know exists.
Right, totally.
In fact, I think you told me that when I told you what I do.
Absolutely. That's why I wanted you on the podcast.
So yeah, what I do is essentially help companies who are big or small, but they're all tech, innovative tech companies, in primarily in the healthcare space, but more and more companies that are not necessarily exclusively in the healthcare space, but they want to develop products to help people be healthier. And that could be fitness limited, it could be for a specific medical condition, it could be for a chronic condition, it could be for an infection, anything you could imagine that essentially is in the healthcare space, but is not something that is a pill that you swallow. That's a medical device in a nutshell. And there's obviously a more complicated statutory definition, but
sure,
that's how I explain it to newbies. And what I do is I help them figure out this maze of laws and regulations for how to get onto the US market in a lawful way. And so sometimes that is pretty easy. If it's a category of devices that is very common in the US, a wheelchair or COVID tests are not easy necessarily, but they came up a lot in the last 2 years. Other times it's something that's much more novel that does something new or that treats a condition that has never been treated using a medical device before. And so that's something where it's a little bit more of put on your thinking hat and be creative and use your knowledge of agency precedent, agency being the Food and Drug Administration, to figure out and put forth a position to FDA as to how it should be regulated.
The follow-up question is, it's not litigation, obviously, it's not transactional work, and it's a particular type of regulatory work. I still have a little bit of a hard time figuring out what you're doing in your office every day. Are you filling out forms? Are you meeting with the clients? Are you meeting with the agency? What kinds of communications happen? How do you advocate on behalf of your clients and advise your clients in your space?
So I'll give you maybe a hypothetical example that can explain a little bit. So new client comes in, it's a small startup company that has this nifty new smartphone app that they want to develop that is going to help people, I don't know, teenagers, take pictures of their acne. And this is not a real product that I know of, by the way, just
sure,
totally made up. It could be, but take pictures of their acne and send it to their doctor and help them figure out whether it's something that needs to be treated or how it should be treated, et cetera, et cetera. So they know that this is in the healthcare space. It may or may not be regulated by FDA, and they don't know how to figure that out. So they would reach out to us. We would have an initial call, or they would provide us with, after all the formalities, the engagement letter and all that. But then they would explain to us what their product does, maybe show us screenshots if it's a software device. And then we would usually do what's called a regulatory analysis, which is basically using our experience and our knowledge of all the databases that are out there and our experience with FDA, because we have over 700 clients in this space, we would put them in a bucket or two potential buckets and help them understand, if you want to make this type of claim, then you would fall into this bucket. But if you could tweak your marketing a little bit or could tweak your technology a little bit, maybe you would have a simpler path. And then it's their decision as a business to decide whether they want to take on the heavier burden or not. And then from that point, we decide with them, do we need to write a submission to FDA? Do we need to just do internal documentation that kind of justifies your position? So if FDA ever comes knocking, you have something to defend yourself with. Or is it something where you're just in a completely new space and then we need to do something a little bit different, like a more of an informational meeting with the agency as opposed to a formal submission to get their initial feedback? Because it's just something that we don't think has ever been really addressed. And then there's also just the what we call counseling, just run-of-the-mill counseling. So once you already have a product on the market, you want to develop a new marketing brochure. How do I make sure that I'm not saying things I'm not allowed to say? That's something I do a lot in my particular practice. Or you just had an issue with a batch of products that you think has a safety problem. What do you do? It's already on the market. So those kinds of things are more just the one-off questions. So a lot of communication with FDA directly, which has been really interesting for me as I get more senior. And then a lot of actual drafting of advocacy and regulatory submissions and scientific writing, to be honest.
Yeah, what I love about that is it sounds like, and I've asked some people who do regulatory work questions like this before, it requires you to pull on a larger set of skills that we learn as young lawyers or in law school. It's the predictive writing, what's going to happen. It's the strategic planning, what could you do to stay within the box. It's the advocacy writing, we know we're not in the box, but we're going to try to tell you we are or we aren't in the box you think we are. And I imagine that is a challenging set of skills to learn, not to mention the substantive areas of law and the substantive work of your clients. How do you start a career like that before you've really, you know, had the experience to do it?
Yeah, it's really interesting hearing you put it that way, because I've never heard it said that way, but it's 100% true. I think for me, I came into it, I initially wanted to be a doctor. So I always knew I wanted to do something in healthcare. Both my parents are doctors. But then I was in college and organic chemistry was just not my thing. And I had no interest in going to med school for 4 years and then residency and then everything else. I just wanted to get into the workforce. So I took this path where I did some consulting and I realized that everyone ahead of me had some kind of advanced degree, but hey, some of them were actually lawyers and they managed to advise in the healthcare space, either on the policy side or on the science side, with a law degree. And that was something I'd never really explored. And so I took that route. And what that allowed me to do was to work more on the kind of advocacy and broader spectrum side of the healthcare space. So I'm obviously not advising patients on how to treat their conditions, but I still feel every day I'm making this tiny contribution to global health, which is what I initially wanted to do as an 18-year-old. That doesn't really answer your question from a skills side of things.
No, it's really interesting to say that's how you got there. And I, after having done soon to be 50 of these interviews, one of the things that I keep hearing is people found law by doing something else and realizing that the other people around them or the people doing the next job that they wanted was legal. One of my first interviews was with a patent lawyer who was a former sort of a former chemist. And he was like, the lawyers got to do the fun stuff. And so I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. Yeah. And it sounds like you were doing this kind of healthcare consulting work and saying, hey, there are lawyers that are part of this world. I had no idea. This is great. I guess my question, we'll come back to the skills maybe, is once you make that decision, did you know all throughout law school that this is what you wanted to do and therefore you tried to fill up on the right classes and skills and internships to make that happen?
So a little bit yes and a little bit no. So I went into law school with an idea that I wanted to do something in the healthcare space, and I'd had exposure to the Food and Drug Administration because I worked in consulting in Washington. So I did have some knowledge of it. I thought it was a cool area and it allowed me to touch on these new technologies that could help patients. So it was something I was very interested in. I didn't know for sure I wanted to do it. The other piece is that most US law schools don't have an FDA track. It's not something that is at Penn, which is a big law school. I took a number of healthcare related courses, and I think one that was about FDA, but most of them were your standard law school classes. And I think what they gave me, to your point earlier, is more of that skill set of like how do I write a good argument when I know my argument is really losing? Mm-hmm. Or how do I do good research? I don't use Westlaw ever, basically, except in my pro bono work. But how do I use the resources that I have? In my case, it's the guidance documents and the agency precedent and the decisions they've made before. Like, how do I pull those together? And it's something that takes some time. And certainly when I was being trained in my first couple of years, and now when I'm training people who help me, it's not something that necessarily comes right away, but if you have the basic tools of how to write well, how to explain well, how to present well, and you like doing that, then that is very helpful. And then the specifics on medical devices, I obviously didn't learn those until I started the job. It's just not something you pick up in law school.
No, you don't learn how to podcast either. So I feel like I'm learning a little bit on the side. But no, I guess my other question arising from that was, what are the things that people can do to set themselves up to be successful in an area like yours? Are there substantive classes? Are there specific kinds of internships or experiences? What sort of gives you a little bit, if anything, a little bit of a leg up on day one before you've actually been able to start practicing in this area?
Yeah, so a couple thoughts on that. I think one thing is, and it might sound a little silly or unusual because what I do is quite particular, but I think that the fact that I took the time in law school to do a little bit of litigation, a little bit of moot court, I took a corporations class, I took a whole bioethics set of classes. And so like, to enable myself to have exposure to other areas has actually made me better able to think through problems that come up. And also to better understand, in my job, I am advising a business. So yes, I am complying with the laws and regulations. That's why they're hiring me. But the benefit and how we set apart our team from our competitors, for instance, is that we provide advice that is actually useful and feasible. So it's not just yes, no. It's yes, but be careful of this, or no, but maybe you could do this alternative. And in order to do that properly, you really have to understand, and I'm not going to pretend that I have an MBA or anything like that, but you have to be able to put on your thinking hat and think about, okay, the law says this, but what is really involved in commercializing a product, or what is really involved in putting in place corporate processes that will allow us to actually do this on a regular basis.
One of the things that I often see students is, I say, predict the likelihood for a client that this conduct is legal or not legal. And I, every year, get two or three people who on that first assignment do not answer that question at all, but instead write me a complete memo about how the product that I referred to could be changed so that it would be legal. And one of the things that I always tell those students, and candidly, I'm a little hesitant to do it, but I do tell them, I said, that the client asks you a particular question, can I do this? You have to answer that question in the first instance before you can go about putting on your business hat and telling them what, how they can change it, because that's not really your lane. I know from having practiced myself that the lanes aren't as starkly divided as that. And I guess my question would be, how would you help somebody who's new at this think about that balance of, I need to answer the question in front of me, but I also, having spent all this time learning the law and learning your client business, have some thoughts on how we could make this work?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. It's certainly, I'm candid about my limitations, right? So when I'm talking to a client, a lot of what I do is really information gathering before I give any real advice. I will look at their device description, for example, and I'll literally put in comments in the document. I don't understand this mechanism of action, because those are things that will lead me to advise them one way or another as to how FDA is going to regulate. Or for instance, there's a claim in their brochure. This is a different example. Product X is superior to product Y by 20%, right? My question would be, what is the data that you have to support that? If I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know how you collected that data and whether you showed it to FDA or not, then I can't advise them properly. And so a lot of it is really just recognizing what you need to know. And that's a skill that you can start doing even from a first year associate. Maybe there's some questions you have that you should already know the answers to, but either way, you can always ask questions.
And how do you go about sort of brass tacks dealing with a new product that you're unfamiliar with? What kind of questions do you ask yourself? What kind of processes do you have in place to review information? And are you ever afraid of going back to the client and saying, tell me more?
Yeah. So no, I'm not afraid of going back to the client. The first couple times it can feel a little embarrassing, but they know that we're not in their company. And so I guess what I would say is I ask them for details on the product. There are two big criteria for how a device is regulated. The first one is intended use. What does it do? Who does it treat? Who uses it? Doctors, physicians, consumers? What condition? And what are the kind of use limitations. It contraindicated for a certain population. Basically, how can it properly be used, and what kinds of claims are you going to make in your marketing? That's prong one. And prong two is, how does it actually work, right? Is it even a device? If it's metabolized, it's not a device. If it's a cosmetic, it's not a device. So all of that. And so basically, it's intended use and technology. I need to understand those two things, and I need to understand them well. Otherwise, I'm going to give you a wrong answer.
I like the way you phrase that too. I think it can be scary. And I had this experience as a junior associate going to a client and saying, you said that something does this. And my understanding, having read everything publicly available that you've given me, is that it actually doesn't function just the way that the documentation you gave me.
Right.
And going back can feel a little bit awkward, like you're telling them they're doing their own job wrong. But the way you phrased it is, they're not doing their own job wrong. You just need to understand how it works so you can explain it to other people. And if you can't do that, then you can't provide helpful counseling.
A lot of it is that a lot of the people I deal with are not lawyers. Most of the people I deal with are not lawyers. They're either engineers, or they're marketing folks, or they're VP of operations. And so they've never talked to FDA. They don't know what FDA looks at. They know their product is a medical device, because you can figure that out pretty easily if you can Google. But other than that, they don't know why really, or what things might change that assessment, or maybe not change the assessment of is it or is it not, what kind of data do I need to support it, and what kind of things can I say about it. And so my job is really not so much to tell them you're doing your job wrong, but here are the things that you haven't explained to me that I'm sure are in the back of your brain somewhere, but I need to understand them.
That's interesting. It must be interesting working with both engineers on the one hand and marketers on the other, who strike me at least intuitively as very different populations that say different things. And you have to be an interface between the two, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Some people in my practice call what we do translating law to scientists and science to lawyers or regulators.
And do you think it helps to have a scientific background to be able to be effective in your position, or can you be a English literature major and do what you do?
That's funny. My dad was a literature major who went on to become a doctor. So it's a question that is actually near and dear to my heart. I think it helps. I think it is certainly not unhelpful. I don't think it's required. And I do get this question a lot. I think you need to be curious. You need to know how to research, and you need to care. And if you have those three things, and you're willing to spend a little bit of extra time on the weekends or in the evenings, non-billable, to actually get the ropes, then you can do it even without the background. But what you can't do is come into it just thinking it's going to be the same as any other lawyer job, because it is very scientific. And so if you're not interested in the science, if you're not interested in understanding these cool new technologies, and then going to the dentist and being like, hey, I actually worked on that product, if that doesn't make you feel like a cool nerd, then it's probably not the space for you.
A cool nerd. I love that. I absolutely love that. And what kind of timelines do you work on in your business? Are you the sort of lots of fire drills, 3 days straight, no sleep, mergers and acquisitions? Are you the 9-month long-term deadlines of litigators? What's sort of the pace of your work?
Yeah, so that doesn't really have a good answer, because it really depends on what the client is trying to accomplish. So most of the FDA submissions that we do are on anywhere from a 3-month to a 3-year path, with multiple communications with FDA on that path. And so for those, it's more of advanced planning. Let's put together a Gantt chart and figure out what data we need when, and when we need to review this argument, and when we need to have the full file together, when we need to submit, and then when we're going to meet with the agency, and then when we're going to respond to their questions. And so it's this whole timeline. But for a lot of other things, especially on the post-market side of things, we just got a letter from FDA. If we don't answer in 15 days, they're going to not allow us to sell our product. So that's a lot more of a fire drill. And then there's also kind of business fire drills, right? The investors want this answer now. So right. If you don't give it to us, we're going to lose our funding, and then we can't proceed.
Right.
So I'd say most of my work is not quite the whole stay up all night, but there's definitely days where you work till midnight, because you just have so many of the one-offs that just need to get handled right away.
No, that makes sense. And it's interesting to even hear you talk about how you have to plan everything for those longer term filings and Gantt charts. And I can't tell you how many times I talk to lawyers who say we need to teach more sort of project management in law school. That skill is becoming increasingly part of the profession, literally no matter what you do, whether you're a solo practitioner or you're at a big firm or you're at a government agency or you're in-house. What kinds of project management skills do you see needed in your sort of area of work? But also, what are some of the things that you've done that you wish you had learned earlier to be able to manage projects and manage your time and your team's time better?
Yeah, so that's something that I think has become increasingly important, especially, well, I don't want to say especially because I don't have experience outside of big law, but big law, like our rates are quite high. And so clients don't want us wasting time. And if we are not efficient, they're going to go find somewhere else. And especially in my area, millions of arguments why we tell people that we provide added value as lawyers as opposed to consultants. And I fully believe that. But the flip side is lawyers are much more expensive than consultants. Mm-hmm. And some of what we do can be done by a good regulatory consultant. And so we really do need to be efficient and figure out how to meet the timelines that are needed without spending 10 hours figuring out a question that could take two. As far as specific skills, it's a learning curve. I definitely came into it having no experience with project management, and you figure it out as you go. I think now a lot of the big law firms are trying to incorporate some of that into their training. Mm-hmm. I had to take a training on budgeting recently. So there is some of that's getting worked in, but I agree with you. It's not something that you come in knowing how to do.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's also something that is part of the process. You've been doing this work at a big law firm and the same big law firm for a while now, and you're not expected to manage the whole project from day one. You get a piece of the puzzle, and then you get a quarter of the puzzle, and then maybe you get half the puzzle, and then you're in charge of other people and their pieces. Yeah. Is that sort of how you've been brought up within your firm?
No, that's a really good point. And I think the other thing I would say, and it's less of a direct project management skills, but more of a how do I even get there tidbit, is to make sure that you understand where your piece in the beginning fits into the bigger picture. Because if you don't, then when you get given more pieces, you don't know how they fit together. I ask a lot of questions. People know this of me. I'm sure that there are some people who find it annoying, but it has helped me. It has helped me both on the logistical side and on the substantive side to just make sure that I'm up to speed on everything that I need to be on.
Right. There, people are annoyed with people who ask questions until the question that went unasked is the reason why everybody else is working a weekend, or you can't charge the client for 40 hours of work that you now have to do.
Right.
And then it starts becoming a lot more convenient that you were a question asker. Exactly. What's your favorite part of your job?
Yeah. So one of my favorite parts is actually interfacing with the regulators. And so there's a number of ways in which we do that. I don't need to necessarily go into all of them right now. A lot of it is on specific submissions. Client X wants to sell device Y and needs to submit an application and then respond to questions. And we do that for them. Now, obviously, because they are the ones who develop the product, if there's questions about the technology or the testing, we rely heavily on their expertise. But as far as explaining it to the regulators, that's on us. And so when we're in these meetings and FDA kind of makes a comment that is not favorable to our client, it's our job to pull them back to the best we can. And the first couple of times I did that, obviously it's diplomatic and it's got to be polite and respectful because they are the deciders at the end of the day.
But, right. They are judge and jury.
Exactly. But at the same time, what do you do as a lawyer? You have to advocate zealously on behalf of your client. And so if they're starting to go into an area where that will just be impossible to do commercially, you have a responsibility to point that out. And they may or may not care, but at least you got to try. And so I find that to be very challenging, or at least it was the first couple of times I had to do it. I learned a lot from watching the people above me do it. And it's not something that always has to happen. One of the things on the flip side that I really like about my job is that the FDA, at least in the Devices Center where I work, they're really supportive of innovation. They have certain standards, they have certain rules, but as a general thing, like, they want innovative products to get to patients. And you see that throughout. And during COVID, it was really, I say during COVID as if it's not going on. First 6 months of COVID, I guess, to your question earlier, was one where my entire group was working around the clock, but so was FDA. And that was pretty fascinating to get emails from government reviewers at 2:30 in the morning on various emergency use authorization applications or enforcement questions. And it made you feel like, okay, we're all part of a team. Yes, we're on the client side and they're on the government side, but really, we all want the same thing. We want this pandemic to be controlled, right?
Sure.
And the question is, how do you do that in a way that properly balances risk and benefit? You can't just let everything go on the market because that's going to hurt people. But you obviously have to waive certain general rules that are more stringent because otherwise more people are going to die too quickly. And so it forced us all and all the practitioners, all the companies and the FDA to really weigh, like, what's really important, what's really necessary, and what maybe isn't, or what can be delayed. It was an interesting case study.
Yeah, and I guess I was going to ask a little bit later, but I want to jump to it now. This feels like should be a growing area, just generally speaking, based on everything you've said, both the fact that we have a global pandemic going on, but also we're having yet another tech renaissance where everybody's wearing these very complicated health devices on their wrists. Is this a growing area of law as well, and not just a growing area of tech?
It is. And I think one of the things, I guess, another thing I really love about my job is that it puts me at the forefront of these questions that don't necessarily have an answer yet. And so for all of these wearable products that you're mentioning, like, this is a pretty new space. The Apple Watch is probably the oldest one, but there's a ton of other products that are worn in different ways on the body that do different things. Some of them are used in clinical trials. Some of them are used to monitor heart rate or things like that. Others monitor, especially during COVID, oxygen saturation, or others yet monitor sleep. Some of them do all of the above. And so there's a lot of questions as to, okay, we have standard devices that have been sold for 30 years that monitor those things. But what changes when you're selling them direct to consumer, or when you're implementing them in a completely different way technologically, right? Like, for example, with sleep, if you have a wearable versus a polysomnography device where you have to go to a sleep lab and get strapped into a bed with all these sensors and stuff, those do the same thing as far as indication for use. They're tracking the same general metrics of your sleep, but do they do it accurately comparatively? And what other different considerations matter when you're figuring what is safe and effective, basically?
One of the things that you mentioned was you were working in kind of the software space. And I'm just curious if that's a new and emerging area of your practice as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good question. It's probably the space where we see the most new types of clients, because it's a space where, you know, traditionally a medical device was this piece of something that you could hold in your hand or that would get implanted into your body. And because of what the definition of a medical device is, it's become obvious that software, which is really tangible, can be a medical device if it's treating a condition, basically, and it's not metabolized. So all of these things, like that smartphone example I gave earlier that would like scan pictures of your acne, could potentially be regulated by FDA. And a lot of companies are now realizing this and thinking, I don't know anything about FDA. I'm a tech company. What do I do now? And one of the things that I enjoy working with clients on is some clients want to be regulated, some clients don't, right? There's pros and cons to both. And so there's a lot we can do on both ends. If you don't want to be regulated, there are often things you can do to tweak things or limit your claims or your marketing or your patient population to make regulation less likely. And on the flip side, if you're willing to take on the burden, there's a lot more potential commercial value to having the stamp of approval that comes with being fully reviewed by FDA.
It sounds like you're basically, the pie is a little bit expanding of what even might be regulated in your space as the technology has allowed potentially more types of things that might need regulation.
Correct. And FDA is also facing this question, right? Like software as a medical device is not brand new anymore, but when I started 7 years ago was not a very usual thing. And now it's probably about 50% of the work that I do.
And let's say somebody's been listening to this and they say, you know what, that sounds pretty cool. I maybe have never thought of it before, but I might want to do this. Obviously, it's something you can do at a big law firm here in DC, as you do. But what are the other ways to participate in this space? The two I've heard, obviously, are representing the clients, bringing these things to market, and on the government side, working with the government to decide what gets approved and otherwise. Are those sort of the two big centers of gravity in your world?
Those are two of the big ones. I guess the third one would be joining a company in-house and working in their, probably on their legal team, but could be on their regulatory team or on their strategic team. Some of the smaller companies use us as that team, but the bigger companies all have their own teams, and then they use us for extra things that they don't have covered by their team. So I just use the word team time. Anyway, my point being that you can go in-house and you can be the non-Hogan Lovells counterpart to Hogan Lovells, the person who's the wealth of knowledge in-house, and then they pull us in for kind of very specific questions that the in-house person may not know.
And does this work mostly happen in DC, or does it happen in other cities as well?
I would say the bulk of it is in DC because that's where FDA is, but there's companies all over the world. So there's a big presence of tech companies, as everyone knows, in Silicon Valley. There's a lot of tech companies in Israel. There's a bunch in China, Japan. That's the other thing that's really cool is I get to talk to clients from 10 countries in any given week, which is really neat because I get to learn about what's going on in their world and what's important in their kind of industry, in their part of the world, because everyone wants to get on the US market. The number of clients who reach out to us from other countries with other kind of jurisdictional rules for marketing and promotion and compliance is fascinating to me. And it's something that I think has also expanded my ability to think about things, because you learn a little bit about the regulatory frameworks in those countries and you're, huh. I just did a podcast with a colleague of mine in Germany where we compared the marketing rules for device companies in Germany versus in the US. And it was eye-opening for me how different these things can be.
Absolutely. And the other question about how to do this work is not just where you can do it, but how do you show demonstrated interest? One of the challenges that I have with my students all the time is they say, I think I want to go into litigation because that's what kind of the first year of law school teaches you, is about all the subjects that deal with litigation. How do people ultimately find their way? One way obviously is yours, which is to have a little bit of a sense beforehand that I want to work in this general field or health. What are other ways to find your path to this kind of work?
I think what I tell a lot of law students who reach out to me, especially if there's someone who's not particularly inclined to go litigation or corporate and just doesn't really know what else is out there, is to just try a lot of things. I did try a lot of things. I knew I didn't want to do corporate, but I was interested in litigation. So I did some moot court stuff. I did some mock trial stuff. And I will say that it was a very tortuous path, but everything I picked up along the way was in some way useful. I'm not going to say that my bioethics degree is directly applicable to my day-to-day work, but it does help me think about questions when I'm reviewing a clinical trial report or a broader policy issue once in a while. And so I think you have to be willing to put yourself out there and be creative. And I know I've said that before, but be creative as to how something can actually help you get where you're ultimately going to go.
Totally. Take small bets. I tell that to my students all the time. If you do a summer internship and all you learn is that you never want to do that again, that's a huge win. I was going to ask you about your master's. As somebody who also has a master's in an area that I don't use, would you do it again knowing what you know now?
I would.
And why is that?
So I think I initially was going to get a master's in public health because I thought it was perhaps a little more directly applicable to what I thought I wanted to do. But that would have required me to stay on an extra year. And Penn had a program where the bioethics department was very invested in cross communication among the different Penn grad schools. And so they made it very easy to get a joint degree, be it law or medicine or social work and bioethics or nursing or MBA even. And so the benefit of that program was it gave me the opportunity to think about questions I was not presented with at the law school, but to think about them from a lawyer's perspective, also considering the perspective of nurses and social workers and future doctors. And so it gave me a much more well-rounded view of the world, as opposed to being stuck 100% in the bubble, as we called it. Although, of course, I loved the bubble, but just the opportunity to step out of the law school a couple times a week and think about issues using what I'd learned in law school, but also seeing everyone else's standpoint. Because really, in the real world, that's what people want. They don't want you to just read the regulations to them. They want you to apply them.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I guess I have just a few more quick questions. One of them is, you've been in big law now for a fair amount of time. There are plenty of off-ramps to being a big law lawyer, and you've chosen to stay on for longer. And I guess my question is, what have you done that has made being a big law lawyer for a longer period of time a sustainable both professional and personal life? And also, what are some of the things that you've liked about that process, or maybe have been more challenging but you found ways around them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't know going in that I was going to spend 7+ years in big law, and now I'm really not sure that I ever want to do anything else. It's a possibility. My ears are open, but my thinking has changed. And I think part of the reason for that is because what I do is so substantive to a large degree that it gets more interesting the more you do it. In other words, when you talk to someone at the beginning, we started with what even is a medical device, right? And so people don't realize that there's this whole field of law. But now, as I've become like a go-to person in my practice for advertising and promotion, for example, like there are questions that are up and coming that no one would even realize are questions. But as I know more and as I'm able to just talk about the basics in my sleep, I realize there's this whole other layer. And going back to the cool nerd thing, like that interests me. And so I think part of what has made it work for me is my ability to keep learning as I go and turn that learning into advice to clients to the extent I can.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate the idea that that what keeps you going is doing new things that build on your prior experiences.
Right.
Because I do hear that sometimes when people leave big law, one of the reasons they do that I've heard is, I was just doing the same thing every single day. Mm-hmm. And I was tired of it. And I looked at the men and women ahead of me, and they were doing the same thing I was doing, and I couldn't see a life doing that. I guess the other challenge is just a matter of work and work-life balance and hours. How have you managed to survive that for 7 years?
Yeah, so that's something that I think anyone in big law faces. I do think it's usually easier in regulatory practices than in litigation or corporate. Not always, not during COVID, but usually. Look, I think it is a lifestyle choice at a certain point. If you're someone who's unwilling to give up some weekends or at least parts of weekends and some evenings or at least parts of evenings, then it's not going to work. If you're always fighting it, it's not going to work. But if you are interested enough and enjoy what you do enough to invest in it, and I'm not saying not to set boundaries, everyone should get vacations, but I talked to some friends who they're among my greatest friends in the world, but the idea of working a weekend for them is just anathema to their existence. And so that's not, they couldn't do Big Law. They just couldn't. For me, if I like what I'm doing, it's not the end of the world to work 4 hours on a Sunday afternoon.
My other question is, you've moved into this role of senior associate, which I always think is one of the most powerful roles in law that nobody talks about, because you have to manage down and manage up in a way that you probably don't ever have to do again. Now that you have people that report to you, or at least that you're helping train or are part of your teams that you on a day-to-day direct a little bit, are there things you wish you knew when you were in that more junior role that you now try to convey to those more junior folks?
Oh, 100%. I probably have a running list of things that I wish people had helped me understand in my first year that would have made my first year easier. I'm very candid with our new associates about that. And I think maybe some people would say that's not the best approach, but I think it is. Not to say that I scare them, but I tell them honestly, look, I'm picking on your writing style. And it's not because I care whether you're a good or bad writer. It's because in what we do, form and substance are not two distinct things, right? What we do is advocacy. And so, yes, you have to get the writing right. You can't report the data inaccurately. Like, that's number one. But if you're making an argument to fit into a lower regulatory class than you typically would, like, your writing has to be polished. Otherwise, they're just not going to understand your argument. That's one example. But there's a lot that you, as a first-year associate in most regulatory practices, I think, because they're so substantive and it takes a while to get your legs, there's a lot that's just like sink or swim. And so I try to do my part to walk junior associates through that a little bit. At a certain point, you have to be dedicated personally. You can't do it all for them, but
sure,
I do try.
Yeah. And the form substance point is one I'm interested in. As a legal writing professor, I often tell students early on that it's that legal writing is technical writing, and I get a little bit of pushback. And I'm quick to say, I don't mean that it's the same thing as writing the instructions to how to put together a shelf, but it has conventions, and each genre within legal writing has its own conventions of what's supposed to be said, where it's supposed to be said, and what level of depth it's supposed to be said at. And it sounds like in your world, that is paramount. It's not just substance. It's also how everything's organized and the kind of package that it's presented in.
Yeah, it is. And I think that is one of the differences between the more senior people in my space and the people who leave. And I don't mean that in a negative way. You can get very far without being a great writer. And not necessarily everyone who gets very far is a great writer. And I think I'm a pretty good writer. Who knows? But my point is that it does go hand in hand, right? If you're trying to advocate for a client, which is what every lawyer does at the end of the day, you need to know the substance, but you also need to know how to present it. And that will change depending on whether you're writing a brief for a court, an appeal to the FDA, or a pre-submission, which is more of an informational document. But in any of those situations, there is a right way and a not so right way, even if there isn't a flat out wrong way.
I love that. And I'm definitely going to share this with my students because it's exactly the advice we give them. Know your purpose, know your audience, and write to the conventions of that purpose and audience.
Yeah. And I will say that I've gotten feedback from the FDA that, like, this is important, right? Like, they know my practice group because not only because we file submissions all the time, but because most of what we file is well put together. And I'm not saying that to pitch us. You should talk to us if you want to, but I'm just saying it's something that does get recognized, even if it's not always the first thing that comes to mind.
Absolutely. And that makes a ton of sense. Look, we're coming to the end of our time. And so I always end these conversations by asking, I've asked for some advice along the way, but a particular type of advice, which is something you would tell someone who's just graduating law school or even just starting law school, whether or not they're interested in sort of your practice area, just one thing you'd leave with the future of our profession.
Sure. Yeah. I guess one thing I've thought a lot about recently in my practice, and something that could apply to a new lawyer, maybe not quite yet to a law student, but certainly to a new lawyer, especially a regulatory lawyer, but probably any new lawyer, is really just one thing that I now understand that I didn't at the very beginning, is that clients really want someone who helps them get to where they go. And yes, to your point earlier in the podcast, like, I can't advise them on things I know nothing about, but I also don't need to just be the no person, because that's not going to get me anywhere. I need to be able to explain my reasoning. I need to be able to help them think through options to the extent of my expertise. And so I think the clients that I get along well with are the ones who are comfortable with the fact that I am able to talk them through things and rely on them for the knowledge that I don't have, but not to just be the person who just puts an X on their brochure or on their beta website and just says, this is all wrong. But this is wrong because of this reason. And if you were able to tweak it this way, I don't know if you can, you tell me. If you can, then that would be much less of a risk. And they appreciate that because it gives them a path. They don't know. If I just say something's wrong, they're just like, well, okay, then does that mean the project is dead? And it doesn't always.
Too many lawyers' favorite word is no, when maybe right. their favorite should be because. That's what I just took from your answer. And I think that's so, I just think that's so eye-opening and awesome and fits in, I agree, any practice area. The fun part about the podcast is I talk to people on both sides of the outside-inside counsel divide, and to a person on the inside counsel side or in-house counsel side, what they say is, we don't want no people. We want you to tell us no when we can't do something, but we also want you to tell us if there are paths to yes.
Yeah. Or no, could you consider? Probably not. Maybe this instead, you know?
Right. But that takes a lot more work. It takes a lot more knowledge, and it takes a lot more work on the front end to understand what it is you're looking at in order
it
to
does,
be able
and
to
I would
do
say
it.
That as a new lawyer, you do have to rely on the senior associates and the counsel and the partners ahead of you. Like, you do need to learn the yes and no first before you can think through the alternatives. So right. you shouldn't jump the gun, but you should observe and understand that's the value add you will eventually provide.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, look, Suzanne, this has been super fun. And I hope we now get a whole generation of medical device lawyers listening
Me
in, because I think you're doing awesome work. And as you said, it's a pretty fast growing area of both business and law. It's exciting to be there. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.